Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. On this Veterans Day, we're going to talk now about the challenge of coming home from war. Journalist Sebastian Junger has written a lot about this, and it's the focus of his latest documentary, The Last Patrol, which premiered last night on HBO. Junger's previous two films, Restrepo and Korangal, followed a platoon of U.S. soldiers at a remote base in Afghanistan. In The Last Patrol, Junger is back home in America with two veterans from that platoon, hiking along the railroad lines of the Northeast Corridor, talking about war and what it did to them.
Do you miss combat at all?
Yeah, I do.
The sense of urgency, the excitement.
We were stopped at a rebel checkpoint, like 50-50, they're going to shoot all of us. And I just went numb.
The four of us would set out from Washington, D.C. and walk north. Walking along the railroad lines is completely illegal, so we would have to move fast and stay out of sight. We would have a 300-mile conversation about war.
There was nothing. There was nothing to hide behind.
About what it does to you and about why you miss it.
The Last Patrol is a meditation on war and on coming home. It also honors photographer Tim Hetherington, Sebastian Junger's friend with whom he covered the war in Afghanistan and who was killed in Libya. And Sebastian Junger joins us now from New York. And Sebastian, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's really good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Also with us from Provincetown, Mass. Is Brendan O'Byrne. He was the team leader in Battle Company's 2nd Platoon when he served in Afghanistan, and he joined Sebastian on the walk in The Last Patrol. And Brendan, good to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Sebastian, let me start with you. What inspired you to make The Last Patrol?
I was taking the Amtrak one day with Tim, actually, going down to D.C., and I noticed that there was...
Tim Hetherington, right? Your friend and photographer who we mentioned was killed in Libya.
Exactly. Yeah. And he and I made Restrepo together, and we were going down to D.C., and I noticed that you could walk pretty much along the entire length of the railroad lines from D.C. to New York. And, you know, there's a sort of strip of no man's land on either side of the actual rail. And I said to Tim, listen, man, we could walk this whole thing. Let's do it. And so... I came up with this idea of a kind of high-speed vagrancy. You know, we'd carry everything we needed in our packs. We wouldn't have tents because tents attract attention. Attention attracts the police. We'd have to be below the radar, and we'd move very, very fast. And so that was my idea for this, like, high-speed cruise up the East Coast. Tim was killed, and I ended up doing it with two combat veterans, Brendan, one of them, from Restrepo, and with a wonderful Spanish photographer named Guillermo Cervera, who was actually holding my friend Tim's hand as he died in the back of a rebel pickup truck in Libya.
Mm. But why was it important to you, this idea of doing this high-speed walk along the rail lines, which you mentioned is illegal? Why was that an important element in the film?
Well, you know, if you can hike the Appalachian Trail and you don't engage with America and you're sort of supposed to be out there. One of the things that I liked about walking along the rail lines is there was just a little bit on the other side of the law, which meant you had to be sort of alert and careful, and there were some consequences, some stakes for what you were doing, which of course is one of the things people miss from combat, is that stakes are enormous in combat. And I like the idea that we'd have to figure things out. You don't have to figure anything out on the Appalachian Trail, and you of course don't meet America in this raw form. A railroad line goes straight through the middle of everything, through mm-hmm. ghettos, through rich suburbs, through everything.
Brendan, why did you want to sign up for this walk?
You know, I just wanted to get out of my house and have a heavy pack on my back again. You know, there's something comfortable about being out in the woods and sort of having to survive on your own and, you know, depending on a group. There's something really comfortable in that. And once he told me about the idea, I was like, yeah, sign me up. This sounds perfect for me right now.
You know, one of the first things we heard in that clip is this question, do you miss combat at all? And the answer that we heard, which might surprise some people, was yes. And Brendan, why do some veterans miss combat, and what does that do to them when they try to come home?
There's many reasons why you would miss combat. One of the main reasons, I think, is because the sense of brotherhood and unity that you have inside of combat, it's something that you don't find in the civilian life that much. It's a very comfortable thing to be inside of a group where you're protecting one another and stuff like that. I think that that's the biggest draw. I think that's what I meant when I said I miss combat. I don't miss getting shot at. Well, sometimes I do, but I don't miss the actual firefights as much as I miss the Brotherhood.
Yeah. And what kind of challenges does that pose for folks when they come home? That missing that close Brotherhood and that camaraderie. What happens when you come home and that's not there?
It leaves a big hole inside of your day-to-day stuff. You just have to start worrying about yourself much more than you worry about someone else. And it feels selfish, you know, to start worrying about yourself rather than your friends. So you have to come home and try to fit back into society, and that takes a long time. And some people do it, and some people never get it. I think that you have to find a purpose back in society, and that's a really hard thing to do when you're coming out of combat, where you know your purpose, you know you're fighting for someone else, and that's all feels really honorable. Mm. And you get back to United States, and nothing you do feels really honorable and real and powerful. It just feels all like a facade.
Sure. Sebastian, I've talked to you in the past about this idea of missing what combat does to guys who serve together. I'd love to hear more about that from you and just what you're thinking as you hear Brendan talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I'd like to say that it's, you know, make sure people realize this is not a sort of modern phenomenon. You know, this is not a product of, like, the video game generation who gets, you know somehow hooked on the sort of game of combat. I mean, you can read elements of that in the Iliad and the Odyssey and letters from Civil War veterans and World War I veterans and Vietnam veterans. I mean, I did a screening of The Last Patrol in Savannah, and a woman caught up with me afterwards and said that she wanted her husband that her husband was in his late 60s and he wanted her to watch The Last Patrol because she said he still misses the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
This is an eternal problem. Yeah. And I think just as Brendan said, what's being missed is that intense bond, even with people you don't like very much. And in civilian life, I mean, there's great friendships and all that, but you're almost never part of a group where people would risk their lives for each other even if they don't like each other.
Yeah.
And there's great emotional security in being in that situation. And by comparison, being in society alone feels much scarier than being in combat with a group like that.
Brendan, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you what kind of challenges you've faced since you've been home.
There are numerous challenges. You know, one of the biggest ones was when I was transitioning, I didn't know how to transition from combat to civilian life, so I started drinking very hard, and that was one of my biggest things, was to just put down the alcohol and start coming home, you know, sober. And then just finding a job. As simple as something as finding a job or finding, you know, or trying to listen to your wife and be interested in what her problems are day to day. It's really hard to come home and hear someone's problems, and in the back of your head, you're thinking, that's not a real problem. You know, I know what real problems are. This isn't a real problem. But you have to care, and you have to be engaged, and you want to care. And those are some of the, you know, just personal interactions are very hard when you get home.
Sure. Sebastian, in the film, you describe a sort of highly effective Brendan who you knew on patrol in Afghanistan. You sort of see him reappear, pushing, going the extra mile. Can you tell me about how you saw Brendan change on the last patrol?
Well, on the last patrol, you have to understand, we were living very rough. We were under bridges. We had to collect firewood, get drinking water at night. And when you're living like that, everyone in the group has to sort of, a lot of stuff has to happen. You have to get the fire started. You've got to start cooking. You've just been walking all day long. Maybe you've covered 20 miles. Everyone's exhausted. So what I saw in Brendan was someone who, as exhausted as we all were, was willing to sort of jump up and go get firewood or sort of run ahead to see if that little hill that we're seeing in the distance, like maybe that's a good place to camp. So he'll run up there to check it out so that we don't have to walk there because everyone's tired. And that's the sort of putting the needs of the group above your own comfort, above your own needs, that you see that's very commonplace in combat. And you don't see it in civilian life. And you know, I think the situation we put ourselves in brought that out in Brendan, and it brought it out in all of us. And it's basically what it brings out your better selves.
Yeah, Brendan, you talked openly about some of your struggles with alcoholism. Did this 300-mile walk in the last patrol help? And if so, how did it help you?
Yes, it definitely helped. I'm a little bit over a year sober now. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And I haven't had a year in, you know, a long, long time, over 12 years probably. One of the things that really helped was, you know, my marriage was falling apart. I was in the throes of alcoholism. I had symptoms of PTSD. And just having a break from that stuff, you know, just being be able to pull away from the alcohol. You know, I couldn't drink out on the last patrol. Pulling away from my wife, we weren't talking to her. I wasn't talking to her every day or every minute or being inside the room where she's angry with me. And, you know, just being able to actually engage inside of a group again was really good for my PTSD. So in all ways of all my issues, it was very good for me to be out on the last patrol because I was just able to sit there and think about what I needed to do in my life. What do I need? What's the next step to get better?
Mm. Sebastian, since your friend Tim Hetherington was killed, you made the decision to stop covering war. I'm wondering how The Last Patrol, that film, I'm wondering how that experience affected you.
Well, I was able to re-experience some of the connectedness and group participation of my experience at Restrepo, but without the very complicated consequences of being in combat. I came back from the Korangal pretty altered in some very good ways and some very painful ways. And the last patrol, it was sort of like the best of combat without the bad side. I like to say, you know, we had that bonding without getting shot at.
Yeah. So it's Veterans Day. What's the message in this film that you'd like people to keep in mind as we think about this country's veterans and some of the struggles they might be going through?
Well, we made ourselves marginal in society. I mean, to make yourself marginal, all you got to do is walk out of your house and not come home that night. Mm-hmm. And you're marginal. You're under a bridge. You're on a park bench. You're a marginal person. And there's a lot of vets who actually do have homes, obviously, or whatever. They live like all the rest of us do. But emotionally, they feel marginal in society. And so what I hope is that people watch this film and get some understanding of the experience of not knowing how you fit into society. And there is a way to reintegrate into this society, but it's a complicated one. And I think even if civilians just understood the challenge of it, it would go a long way towards making vets feel understood. I think it goes a lot further than just saying thank you for your service.
Hmm. Brendan O'Byrne, same question to you. What would you like folks to take away from this?
You know, I did this for veterans to realize that we're all going through this struggle together, that everyone's having issues with coming home. Just like in combat, if we can help each other come home, then we're going to come home together a lot faster. Everyone's going to come home a lot faster if we're all helping each other out.
Well, that's Army veteran Brendan O'Byrne. He served in Afghanistan. Brendan, thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
And Sebastian Junger is a journalist. His latest film, The Last Patrol, premiered last night on HBO. Sebastian, thank you.
My pleasure.
In World War II, at age 21, I was a corporal clerk in Battery B, 903rd Field Artillery Battalion, 78th Infantry Division.
This is Ed Clark of Medford, Mass., an Army veteran who served in World War II all over Europe, from the Battle of the Bulge to Remagen to the occupation of Berlin. He came home with a lot of memories and his typewriter, a deep maroon Royal Portable called an Aristocrat, which he's had since he was 16. Over the decades, he's used it to type his letters, scholarly articles, and an autobiography in which he describes going off to war, including the very first night he stood guard in Germany.
Feeling the strangeness of traveling 3,000 miles to stand in a uniform with a gun in the middle of the night to behold a scene more beautiful than snow in my hometown in Ohio. All my friends are tuned into this typewriter, of course, because they all have computers, and I have never used a computer. I'm a curiosity at best, you know. I would say in general about a typewriter that what I've found with it, and I think the reason that I have become so attached to my typewriter, not only that it's a beautiful machine, a beautiful piece of workmanship, I always admire it when I look at it, but also there's something intimate about a typewriter. One feels very close to it. One's thoughts and feelings seem to go straight from oneself to the page. Well, I was drafted into the Army. I had been in field artillery, and we had gone through the war, the Battle of the Bulge, the bridge at Remagen, occupation of Berlin, and after 3 years, the war over, I came back home with my typewriter, and it had just become part of my life. It was a kind of friend, a companion. When all else failed, I could turn to my typewriter and write something on it. This piece is called The Bridge at Remagen, Before, During, and After. We told ourselves we were not in danger. The fighting, somewhere miles away. Our war was with the elements. Midwinter, snow, woods. I stood guard, looking, listening for movement. I adjusted to shadows, to snow pristine, a purity of white, stillness. Something like war came at night. War quickly became routine. Well, that's the status, so to speak, of my life with my beloved, beloved typewriter.
I'll get by as long as I have you.
That's Ed Clark, a veteran of World War II, with his Royal Aristocrat typewriter. He's a professor emeritus of English at Suffolk University. And our profile was produced by Radio Boston's Tim Skog, who has since bought a typewriter.
I'll not complain. I'll see it through. Poverty may come to me. It's true. What care I, say I'll get by as long as I have you.
I'll get by. Oh yes, honey child, I'll get by. Just as long as I have you. And remember, though there be rain, and of course, a little darkness too, I ain't never gonna complain. Mm-mm, not me. I'll see it through.
I'll get by.